Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, August 10th, 2006. First of all, a quick health tip. For a long time, I've been wrestling with an idea that a lot of the so-called products that you get in the healthcare, alternative healthcare industry, such as essential oils, etc., really don't meet the needs of a lot of people. And we're in a time of chaotic change, etc. So although there might be some excellent products there, they don't really meet the needs of the people who are going to need something long-term, something sustainable, something that's going to be there, something that's renewable. Little bottles tend to run out. They tend to get used up or cast aside, or in many cases, people simply don't know what to do with them. So I'm trying in my own, some of my background work to put together something that I simply don't find any place on the market, and that is alternative health remedies that are renewable, sustainable, and usable by the public. And now, you know, the old term for apothecary came from a long time ago, where people learned and transferred information by word of mouth, what herbs, what plants were good for such and such or for healing. And most of the modern medicines we get today actually come from this folklore and tradition that's handed down. And of course, pharmaceutical companies cannot make money off of natural products, so they take and extract, then synthesize, then sell. And you will find that in many new places. For example, a few weeks ago I talked about the cenotes in the Yucatan region, in the Quintana Roo region of southeastern Mexico, where biologists that work for pharmaceutical companies are diving in cenotes, underground caverns filled with water, and looking for new plants, new exotic species that have never been discovered, in hopes of finding chemicals that could then be synthesized, changed, altered, and made into drugs that would be marketable. So this is a huge industry, but the majority of drugs, as I say, are actually derivations of natural remedies, and in many cases, items that have been used for centuries, if not thousands of years. But there's another way to look at this, and some companies have developed products and they put them in little bottles, and you can buy those, and that would be good for 6 months or a year. But after that, then if there's a real crisis in the world, an emergency, those, like I say, those little bottles run out. The products simply may not be that usable, because people simply would lose the information on how to use them if that, and in many cases, there's not good documentation for the general public in the first place. You have to become some kind of a mini expert to simply buy and use a lot of these products or product lines. So what I'm saying is, in the background, I'm working on this and attempting to simplify it, and that's a big task. So something I will continue to work on in the future. Also, I just want to quick mention the healthcare ripoff. I can't believe what is happening to seniors in this country. And it's really not being talked about on what I see as other major talk shows. And so when that happens, I bring them up on this show. And until those talk shows start to bring up these topics, the issue of senior health care, where the recently they wanted everybody to sign up for Medicare. There was a certain date you had to sign up by to get in the program, so to speak. And I just don't see this as a viable method for caring for the elderly as we go into the future. When I see, actually many of these people are well cared for, but the problem is it is tremendously expensive, and it simply taps our society of another valuable resource, where elderly people are literally sucked of their life savings until they are paupers, and then once they're of no more use, they can be spit out. But society really has not found a good solution for old people. One thing I want to say is that you can maintain your health into old age much better if you reduce your acid intake. That would be white flour, sugar, coffee. There's a whole laundry list of items. Red meat is something that most people over 70 years old can't even digest. So, and I've talked about this on many previous shows, for the new shortwave listeners, I once again encourage you to find my website and listen to the archives of all my past shows. They're available both on my website and also the network, Reality Radio Network. The archives are available there and my website. And this past week, I did something for the general audience. I have a simplified web page because my main web page name is jmccanniescience.com, and many people misspell that. And our good friends in the CIA have found plenty of typo squatting sites with similar web URLs or web domain names, as they are called. And so to simplify that, I went out and secured a website this week that's very simple, and it's much easier to repeat on the air. So you can get to my website by going to this pointer website. It is simply www.jmccsci.com. JMCCSCI, that's short for J. McCanny Science. So if you simply go to jmccsci.com, you will get to my webpage. That's JMCCSCI. And unlike most websites, it's all my original work. I don't get anything from other websites, and you won't find links to any place else on my website. There's a good reason for that. I work alone. I've always worked alone, and there are about, at this point, 2.7 gigabytes of information on my webpage, much of it in the form of my radio archives that go back for many years. So I encourage you to listen to those. On to another quick topic, and then I'm going to be talking about tonight the outer planets, the outer moons, and the diversity in the outer solar system, which is a huge topic and something that's very much a surprise to standard science. If the solar system supposedly formed all at one time, which is the standard science explanation for the origin of the solar system, then why are the outer planets so diverse and different? In fact, you could look amongst the inner planets of the solar system and find the same issue, that Venus is extremely diverse from Earth. Mercury is unlike anything we've seen. It's kind of moon-like, like our moon, but it's still very different. And Mars, totally, totally different, although it's very clear that Mars used to be a water planet, but lost its atmosphere and oceans very rapidly and in the recent past, the very recent past, probably just a few thousand years ago. So what is it about this solar system we live in that is so unusual? Why all the diversity if it all formed out of the same spiraling gas cloud? And the answer is that the planets are different because they were all brought into the solar system at different times. capture is the method for securing new members into the solar system, and it has happened many times. It doesn't happen very often because we only have about 9 or 10 planets, and we have about 40 moons, major moons, in the solar system. So capture and acquisition of new solar system members does not happen every day. But we do have sufficient historical record to know that Venus, in fact, is a new planet. But anyway, that will be the main topic, science topic, for tonight's show. Quickly, a couple issues. I want to remind people of the Berkey water filter. And this, I'm finding, people really like this, the idea that I put forth. The big Berkey water filter, it's the only one that I particularly am recommending. And it would come with 4 filters. Now, typically the Berkey is sold with 2 filters. But my own experience, now I use these filters, their gravity feed water filter, and I have come to understand that you need spare filters. For example, filters can freeze and break. Filters can be broken under stress. So if you all of a sudden are standing there with a broken filter, then your ability to filter water has just been cut down. And so you do need extra filters. And if you're looking at a long-term use of one of these, especially in case of emergency that might be 6 months, a year, you do need those extra filters. So there's many good reasons for getting extra filters. So that's why I do not, I don't myself, or I don't recommend that you buy a Berkey without extra filters. So in that light, I'm offering to the public through, and by the way, the pricing on the Berkeys is fixed by the manufacturer. So you're not going to get a better or worse deal by going somewhere else. But what I've done to provide an incentive for you to get one of these, and I highly recommend it because the most important thing in your life is fresh water. I even pour tap water through mine. I take it camping with me, and the Berkey water filter is something that has been shipped to all of the like New Orleans during Katrina. The people with Berkeys had fresh water. You just take anything, any kind of water, any condition, pour it in there, and out comes clean, drinkable, fresh water. Something, as in the Bible, it says that someday, and I believe it's in the Old Testament, I don't have the verse, but it says that someday a glass of clean water will be the most precious commodity on the planet. And I've developed an 800 number for you to call. It's 800-983-5622. That's 800-983-5622. So I'm offering the Berkey water filter with 4 black Berkey filters for $315, and that includes free shipping, and it includes a small radio, the Bell & Howell 9-channel world receiver, free, and free shipping. So, great deal. Also at that number, I'm offering a book set for introductory, for people who are not familiar with my work. I'm offering to the shortwave crew and anybody else who is interested. And by the way, these offers are also on my webpage, on the secure web ordering page, under the www.jmccsci.com or the jmccanniscience.com homepage. But for those who are going there for the first time, use www.jmccsci.com, and you will get to my webpage. But anyway, I'm offering to those shortwave listeners a book offer, also on the 800 number, and that's $89 for the 3 books and my pamphlet and 2 videos, also includes free shipping. It's just a great way to find to get the four books and get started understanding the electrical nature of the universe. And that offer is also explained on the introduction. When you call the 800 number, the offer is explained in detail. 800-983-5622. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about ethics versus legality. Something that I've given entire shows on ethics. Now, that's a course that I took when I was in college, and it's a course that really is not offered anymore. Harvard Business School and Harvard Law School dropped their ethics course, I believe about 10 years ago, because they just didn't think it was necessary. And I want to talk a little bit about ethics versus legality. A lot of times something is not illegal. In other words, you couldn't take it to a court of law and find somebody guilty. And, of course, that all depends on who has the best attorneys and other factors, if you know what I mean. But in ethics, it's something that, as my ethics instructor taught me, he said it's based on natural law. And that's something that's kind of written into your heart. Everybody knows this. If somebody's trying to scam you, pull the wool over your eyes, trick you or trick the public, etc., and it's kind of like everybody knows it. And that's where ethics comes in. Ethics would be the ability of leaders, etc., to operate in an uprighteous manner. And that means no lying, no cheating, no hiding, no conning, no using this reason to get that thing done. The smoke and mirrors, all of the things we see today are highly unethical. I've found that some companies I've been associated with in the past turned out to be very unethical. There's nothing they do that's illegal. Possibly they have good products, but they simply don't operate ethically. And I'm going to be making some public announcements about some of these companies in the near future. Tonight is not the right night for that. But let me just say that it has to do with certain companies, a certain company in particular, that I promoted in the past, unfortunately, only to find out that they internally have extremely unethical practices. And that company dealing with essential oils. You may know who I'm talking about. And a company that I really don't care to have my name associated with because of highly unethical things going on within the company. So companies may have good products. They may have good advertising. They may have good promotions. But if they're not ethical, I simply don't want my name associated with them. Back to ethics, everything we do today and see comes back to ethical standards, and it's something that the world has lost in a very dramatic way, especially in the past 10 years in the business, in the legal profession, in the politics, and in science. In science, if you can get away with it, if you can steal it, if you can put your name on it, even though it's somebody else's work, it might not be illegal because copyrights don't protect you as much as you think it may. Copyrights don't protect you from someone else stealing your work. Copyright simply protects you from someone stealing verbatim your work. And so, in spite of the fact that Congress, through the Constitution, was given an edict by the Founding Fathers to protect inventions and creative thought and art, etc., the copyright laws are so full of holes that, and that's the way it is with patents also, that a good attorney and a liar and an attorney will get you a lot of places these days. But the point being that ethics would stop a lot of this personal responsibilities, all of these being lost in the modern Western society. These are values that are still held in other parts of the world. Ethics versus legality. Just want a quick update on Planet X, something that I will do every week from now on. And once again, remember the calamity back in 2003 that there would be a big orange ball coming in and crashing into Earth, and that it would happen on May 15th, 2003. There's a lot of people who would like you to forget about that little incident and welcome those people back. They would like you to welcome back the disinformation crew that spun that story and the stars of that show, sponsored by your friendly CIA and disinformation crew. But anyway, the real story on Planet X, in a nutshell, is that there is not just one Planet X. There's certainly no serious evidence from a scientific point of view that there is anything on a 3,600-year orbit coming into this solar system regularly on a 3,600-year period. All of these objects associated with the sun come on periodic orbits. So there might be some with a 100,000-year orbit. There might be some with a 6,000-year orbit. There might be some with a 13,000-year orbit. And there might be some with a million-year orbit. We simply don't have the history or scientific data and knowledge to know what the true history of Earth is, how many Planet X objects there are out there. So I call them the extrasolar system objects. And as with anything, as I started using that term, of course, NASA immediately took the term up and bastardized it, that is, changed its meaning, because extrasolar, solar referring to our sun, not just any star, but our star, the sun, solar. So when you say extrasolar system objects, it definitely implies, in my original intention, to encompass all of the objects, all of the solar orbiting objects that could come into our solar system at any time, and have, as I say, have definitely different orbits, could come in from different directions, northeast, southwest, etc., in terms of the solar system. And we simply don't have history on these. So what do you suppose the NASA boys do? They start using the term extrasolar system objects to mean possible planets in other solar systems. So, you know, the obvious here is that it's a distortion of the term. So anything, it seems, that I try and present, any correct information that I try and bring forth to the public, and I think everybody out there fully understands what I'm talking about when there isn't just one Planet X. In fact, that would be almost like imagining there's just one planet, and that would be Earth, and there are no other planets. That would be similar to making some ridiculous statement like that. So clearly, there are many objects out in the far reaches of the solar system and beyond that we know nothing about. NASA has discovered 40 objects in the past 10 years, and that number is growing all the time, plus a couple planet-sized objects out there that lie far beyond Pluto. So clearly, there are many objects out there. We don't have history or tracking on all but a few of these. So the true story of Planet X is we simply don't know. So what is thrown to the public? A bunch of misinformation where they pick a date, and that is the other essential of the Planet X misinformation campaigns. They always pick a date that they know nothing will be here, and then what I call the white hats, the astronomers, who everybody should worship, come in and say, oh, nothing's going to happen, and then when nothing happens with their created disinformation story, it makes the white hats look good. It's a little scripted dog and pony show that they go through every now and then. So just realize that the real story of Planet X is that there are many Planet X-type objects out there, very few of which we know anything about. And of course, the question that most people ask is, when might the next one be here? And my reply has gotten to be a little bit refined. That is, why would you expect, or why would you ever want to know when a Planet X object is going to come when you're totally unprepared? And so preparation for whether it's a man-made disaster, whether it's a black ops, psycho, imitation, terrorist event, or whether it's an extra solar system object coming into the solar system wreaking havoc with the planets, why would you ever consider wanting to know a date for such an event when you're not prepared in the first place? So much of the disinformation revolves around setting up phony dates, such as 2012, one of the biggest phony dates ever created. That's just another Y2K. It's just another date that somebody can hang their hat on, sell a book, get on a radio show and toot their horn. And a great item for the disinformation crew, because it diverts people's attention from the real issues. I just want to go over quickly. I got an email here, which I get regularly, from the American Geophysical Union. Actually, this came in the 4th of August, a day after my last show. And I want to read some of the topics. Now, with most of the people that are familiar with my work and my history that goes back decades dealing with the electromagnetic nature of the solar system, it is very interesting to see the questions that are being asked at the, for example, the American Geophysical Union meetings. These are the kind of the core science meetings where scientists from around the world gather and discuss the current scientific issues of the day. But you can see in these meetings that they are continually asking and breaching the questions that are already discussed in my books, and which reflect my work from 10, 20, 30 years ago. Here's one. It says, we welcome papers on recent broad-based airborne and satellite-based observations and relevant laboratory studies allowing to characterize sources of X-ray radiation associated with thunderstorm activity between different atmospheric regions are also welcome. And the reason I'm pointing this out, I'll just read a couple of these, is because people who have read my books will get a little chuckle out of this, because they know for a fact that I go into great detail explaining how this works, how the solar capacitor drives the electrical nature of our weather on Earth, and in fact, it's explained in detail. So the questions they're asking in the scientific meetings today are already well discussed in my books. This one I get a kick out of, because this next one, because it talks about scientific policy. Scientists, it says, could profit from both in-depth examinations of how science is incorporated into policy and decision-making, and practical training on how to distill their results into meaningful sound bites that can easily be used for public consumption. Now, if you understand what that's saying, they're kind of offering a class here to promote scientists to learn how to talk. And this is something I get a kick out of, because I'm familiar with a lot of these scientists. They can go to a meeting and talk to other scientists on the lingo that they're used to using, but very, very few of them can form a sentence which is understandable by the general public. That's one reason a lot of people listen to this radio show, is to get some science education that makes sense and is not a scientist who's rambling on to try and impress you with how intelligent he is, but cannot make a sentence legible or tangible for the public to even have a clue what they're talking about. So I just find that interesting, that they're going to try and educate scientists on how to talk to the public. Here's another one. Planetary rings and moons typically lie deep within magnetospheres. It goes on to talk. We would like to bring together research from laboratory study, simulation, and data analysis. The goal is to describe the expected limits of exogenic influences on the surfaces of rings and moons. Now, the reason I'm reading this is because this is somewhat of a lead-in to the topic I'm going to talk about, because they are so confounded and confused with the nature of the solar system. Here's another one leading into that same topic. Description of this public scientific meeting, not generally public, but this is, as I said, the American Geophysical Union meeting coming up. The description of this session: the broad diversity of outer planet satellites has been brought into sharp focus by the richness of the new Cassini data sets, the Cassini being the large satellite orbiting Saturn. From equatorial mountain ridges encircling the moon Iapetus to geysers on Euclideus to the strange surface of Hyperion, we continue to expand our understanding of the traits of surprisingly different worlds. Da 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 da. So, it goes on to say, invited presentations would be made that focus on individual moons. And it goes on to basically list some of the acceptable theories that could be used to explain the diversity in the outer solar system. And I want to just read one more for this is the last one, and of course, by work dealing with earthquakes, volcanic activity due to the electromagnetic nature of the solar system. Here's the one session. It says, recent earthquakes have provided and have renewed interest in question of the existence of electromagnetic signals related to strong earthquakes. And it's basically topics. This session will consider the causes, methodology, approaches, and observations of EM phenomena related to earthquake activity. Once again, they are starting to ask the questions that are thoroughly described in my papers and books that are available to the general public. And so that's the bizarre nature of science today, that they are so far behind the times, and this is supposedly the cutting edge of science today. Now, I want to start the lecture dealing with the question of the diversity of planets with something that I saw this week. And, of course, it's summertime, and there, where I was, the windows were open, so some flies got in the house, and they were up against the window. And a window, of course, is a flat two-dimensional surface. And as the flies moved back and forth, buzzing up against the window, and of course they thought that that was a clear path outside, and they spent hours flying back and forth, buzzing up against that window, when just right next to them, if they would have just gone over a little bit of a hump, the little piece of wood trim on the window, they would have been able to fly outside. And even when you take your hand and swat them in the direction of the opening, which is just right next to the window, and as I said, the only thing separating them from a clear path to the outside is this little teeny thin strip of wood. And then more flies accumulate on the window because they see the other fly there, and so before you know it, there's two, there's four, there's six, there's eight, 10, 12 flies all buzzing around this window, all trying to get out, all with the same purpose, but none of them ever able to figure out that if they just flew up, looked at the situation from a distance, and flew over about a foot using, you know, just a little bit of energy, that they were, you know, they were spending all this energy, and they were there all afternoon trying to get out, it just dawned on me that how similar this is to the human race. As people, you know, are locked into what is going on this planet, and literally we live in a two-dimensional world. We're down here on the surface of the Earth. It's kind of a curved two-dimensional world, but even at that, it's two-dimension, and even if you get in an airplane, you only go up to 30,000 feet or cruising altitude of a jet airliner, and that's pretty much our localized position on this Earth. And I thought, you know, how similar the human race is to this group of flies out a window, buzzing around, trying to see, they can see through where they want to be, but just can't get there. Not a single one of them has the brains to just jump up, fly back, take a look around, and say, you know, the opening's right over here, guys. Let's just kind of fly over this little thin strip of wood and get out of here. And if you look at the space program, if you look at what NASA has done over a 30-year period, and now expect us to wait another 20 years before they go back to the moon, which is what they say they did in 1969, you find out that we have a real huge problem with our space program. I've said repeatedly that the real purpose of NASA is to keep the general public from getting into outer space. And it's really true when you find out how simple it is to go into outer space, as with Bert Rutan, with the other people developing, when you see, for example, the Tesla car built by Tesla Motors, an electric automobile with a 250-mile range, you see what can happen when a few people with an intention and a goal get together, how simple it is. How absolutely simple. We're starting to hear talk of $6 a gallon prices for oil. What does this have to do with the outer planets? It has the same fly on the window mode in our scientific community. That they continue to buzz around, they continue to be totally focused and concentrated on buzzing around the little concepts that were developed that everything has to happen in the mode that the solar system created all of these planets, moons, etc. at the same time, and that is the only viable explanation that they will look at. So modern science, modern standard science, not my science, modern standard science is just like the pack of flies on the window. And no matter how much they buzz around, how much energy they put into this, none of them have enough brains to step back and go, hey guys, you know, the answer's over here. And all of the buzzing around you're doing over there on the window is not going to do you any good. So give it up. If you see what I mean. It was so striking when I saw that. Now, I've talked in the past about banking and the system that came into this country, 1913, the banker taxation war group, and you find out that they are all one and the same, that the continual wars we have, a lot of people say it's over oil, it's over the conflict between ethnic groups or whatever in the Mideast. Well, those are the immediate causes, but if you look at the global picture, war, banking, fake money, and taxation are all part of a system that were installed, and it's never going to end unless you get rid of the entire system. And as with science and dealing with the understanding of the solar system, you're never going to understand how the solar system works until you get rid of the entire set of standard theoretical concepts being dumped on us by the standard scientific community. And as you know, I've developed a set of what I call axioms of astronomy. These are the principles, the core basic principles upon which all of astrophysics, astronomy, and space science are based. I call them the axioms of astronomy, and this term actually came from an editor of a journal, astrophysics journal, where I published some articles back in the late 70s. And I was writing letters back then. You wrote letters. There was no such thing as email or web pages. So I was writing a letter somewhat complaining about the inability to get my papers published, dealing with the fact that comets are not dirty snowballs. They're something quite different. And one of the other editors wrote back, and he says that it does make one wonder whether astronomy qualifies as a science, because it's more as a religion. And with the adherence to the dirty snowball comet model, he said it's more like an axiom. There are axiomatic starting points, and that everything has to follow suit. And so from that, I picked up the term the axioms of astronomy and put that in my paper, one of my original papers dealing with the electrical nature of comets and the plasma discharge comet model. The axioms of astronomy, as I defined them back then and as I still define them, the incorrect axioms of astronomy are that gravity is the sole force in the cosmos, which is simply not true. That comets are dirty snowballs, that is not true. And the comets are actually electrical discharges of the solar capacitor by a rocky object, or any object. It could be an icy rocky object that comes into the solar system, discharging the solar capacitor. And the tail material is actually drawn into the nucleus. The third incorrect axiom of astronomy is that the planets all formed at one time. Now, the fourth, by the way, is that there was a Big Bang and that the entire universe was created at one time. So the fly on the window concept of modern astronomy, the fly in the window concept is the what I call the axioms of astronomy. So when scientists go out and, first of all, incorrectly design spacecraft to examine the planets, and then they get the data back, and they are only allowed to analyze this data in terms of the incorrect axioms of astronomy, what you get is the garbage tier 2 science that we are being presented today. You find the outer moons of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune have all kinds of very unusual characteristics. There are geysers, there are oceans of hydrocarbons, there are moons that are completely old and battered right next to moons that are brand new, hot, and volcanic. So if all of this formed all at the same time, wouldn't you expect somewhat of a consistency, somewhat of a regularity to the moons and planets that we see? They're all very different. Take, for example, just little things. Saturn is much smaller than Jupiter. It's much farther away from the sun, yet it puts out 3 times the energy for its size than Jupiter. Isn't that strange? So what exactly causes this? The ring system of Saturn, of course, is so extensive and brilliant that it can be seen from Earth. Yet Jupiter, which is a bigger planet, has a faint ring and hardly a ring system at all. So it's just, where is the logic to all of this? Where is the consistency? Look at Mars, a planet that clearly had water at one point and obviously lost it very recently. A third grader could identify this because of the pristine riverbeds and other water erosion features on Mars that would have been eroded away by the wind and dust storms that continually encircle Mars. These pristine conditions would have eroded away long, long ago if they were created long, long ago. Yet, whenever you hear the NASA explanation, they always put the water on Mars out billions of years ago. And it's kind of a, there are so many people that give me feedback that after they've heard my message, they listen to this and they realize that in fact the standard science that you read in the, say, space.com or any of the standard outlets, Science News or Science or Nature Magazine, that this is all a homogenized, blended form of science for the public. The entire issue of the outer planets, it should have been crystal clear that something very different was going on here. Finally, it was, last Christmas, NASA finally broke down and announced that at least a dozen of the moons of Saturn were recent acquisitions, that they could not possibly have been there with the original system, moon system of Saturn. So one by one, they have to break down the system, but only making rare exceptions here and there, and not coming to the full conclusion that, hey, all of this stuff is, all of these planets, moons, etc., have different ages. They have different formation characteristics. They have different surface, even the surface that we see, which is just a very minor part of these objects, is different from all the other ones. So, with this in mind, I want to give a scenario for a capture of a moon, specifically the moon Io of Jupiter. And this is a hypothetical example to give people a real feel for what it would be like to observe an object coming into the solar system and then being captured by one of the planets. And in this case, it wouldn't necessarily be Earth-threatening, so it would be a Planet X-type scenario, but one that wouldn't necessarily cause tremendous damage to Earth. You have to understand that when any of these objects come in and discharge the solar capacitor, the Sun would go out of its normal patterns, and that in itself could affect Earth simply through weather, through electrical conditions, and through electrical currents passing through the solar system, which would drive potentially severe weather on Earth. But just for the sake of example, let's say that all of this activity is pretty much limited to the outer solar system, and we just get a tremendous light show. So let's start at the very beginning. We're living on planet Earth. We look up in the sky one day, and remember that every orbit is different. Every scenario, every capture scenario is different, and it's almost impossible to say that if we saw something coming in, would it be Earth-affecting or would it not be Earth-affecting. If such an event happens, tune into this show where you'll get the most complete information on whether this potential object would be Earth-threatening or not, because you certainly won't get it out of your friendly, tax-paid, local government science-supported science. So at any rate, imagine as a hypothetical example, we're on Earth here, people are working, going about their daily lives, and all of a sudden at night, you look up into the sky, and let's say that Jupiter is in the night sky at the time. And out in beyond, far beyond, you notice a kind of a fuzzy ball, kind of a whitish but just very faint object. And say announcements come in that there's a new comet in the solar system, because it would look like a comet. And let's imagine that the orbit of this comet brings it past Saturn, relatively close, and there could be potentially an energy exchange between Saturn and this new object coming in, which would reduce the comet's, the newcomer's, energy and orbit and capture it into the solar system. Now, if it were in the plane of the planets, then it has potential to remain a member of the solar system, and it's kind of a celestial billiards game at this point. But my hypothetical example tonight is just concentrating on an object that would come in and be captured by Jupiter. Now, remember that the comet tail material is being drawn into the comet nucleus, causing what I call the tail drag. That alters the orbit and reduces the energy of the orbit, so this object, the nucleus of this comet, and let's imagine that it's the size of Io. In other words, about, for all practical purposes, on a scale similar to our own moon's size. But it's out in the outer solar system. The public would see this fairly large comet, maybe about the size that Hale-Bopp looked in back in the mid-90s. About that size in the night sky. You could see it with the naked eye, but even a good pair of binoculars, or even an average pair of binoculars, would bring in a fairly good view of this comet. As it winds its way through the solar system, the path of this comet, let's say hypothetically, brings it close to Jupiter, a little bit outside of Jupiter's orbit, but nonetheless into the gravitational realm of Jupiter. So the movement of this comet is based on gravity, the gravitational interaction of the nucleus of this object with the other planet, Saturn, of course, just captured, reduced the energy. It's now moving off towards Jupiter. And as the energy is reduced, I want to give just a simple example. Take a plastic bottle and stand away from your kitchen sink and an empty plastic bottle, just a small one, toss it in the sink. Now, in a perfectly elastic collision, that plastic bottle would bounce out of the sink and go just as far as distance as you threw from which you threw it in a perfectly elastic collision. But we know from say throwing a tennis ball against the floor or bouncing a basketball, they don't come back to the same height that they began with, and that's because some of the energy is lost. In the case of a basketball, some of it turns into heat, or a tennis ball, some of that energy turns into heat energy, some of it turns into the sound created when the ball hits the floor, etc. So some of that energy is lost, and that's why the tennis ball or the basketball doesn't reach the same height. That's why the plastic bottle being thrown in the sink doesn't bounce out. A lot of times it'll just remain in the sink, bounce around a little. And I use the sink example because that's very similar to a gravitational well of a planet like Jupiter or Earth, for example. And so with the energy being reduced, the comet energy of its orbital energy being reduced by the tail drag, it slowly moves in towards Jupiter and possibly interacts with some of the other moons of Jupiter, creating another capture scenario. And within a number of years, maybe 10, 20 years, it starts to encounter the moons of Jupiter as it orbits and falls inwards, the tail drag causing it to fall closer and closer to Jupiter. And in this respect, in working through the mini solar system around Jupiter, this object could nestle in and become the innermost moon of Jupiter, and it would look like a very volcanic, very hot, very new surface, and that is exactly what you see with the moon Io. This is how it would work. Now, the mathematics, the details of this, of course, are far more complicated, but I wanted to give kind of a running scenario, just a very simple example of how capture would work to bring a new object into the solar system, potentially to become a new moon, one of the inner moons of Jupiter. And most scientists would say, well, how could it get in there without encountering the other moons of Jupiter? Well, it does encounter the other moons of Jupiter, and not by direct collision, but by gravity. And it could cause a bit of damage to these moons, forming mountain ridges, etc. And gee, guess what? That's exactly what you see on many of these moons in the outer solar system. Ridges of mountains things that simply are not explainable by dust collecting in kind of a big fuzzy nebular cloud out there at the beginning of time, supposedly when all the planets formed at one time. Clearly, that is not what happened. The planets and moons all have different ages. The solar system is a walking history of objects that came in at different times. And so it is amazing, as we watch scientists, as I go to these meetings, the American Geophysical Union meetings, and have to stand there with the other scientists as they grapple over these obvious contradictions to their theories, and they make up every sort of excuse, band-aid theory, and all based on the incorrect axioms of astronomy. One thing I introduced in my earlier work was the concept of X-rays and comets, something that's very common now and discussed at these scientific meetings. But once again, never realizing that we live in a very electrified solar system, all the theories that are supposedly accepted for this now realized, now measured, now measurable phenomena of X-rays in front of comets, X-rays around Earth, X-rays around thunderstorms, X-rays around the rings of Saturn, on and on, all being described, or in scientific terms, in terms of standard gravitational or processes that really do not include electromagnetism. But people in these scientific groups are starting to get a clue. They're starting to talk in terms of electromagnetism. But of course, none of them have time to read the work of people that have gone before them and put it together. They're all trying to rediscover or recreate the wheel, but the albatross around their neck is the set of axioms that guide their basic principles. And as I said, with the flies on the window, unless one of them steps back and goes, "Hey guys, this is all wrong. We're flying and buzzing around this window and we'll never get out unless we step back and look over here," and the solution is not buzzing around the window. I just want to take the last minute or so to discuss the weather of the past week. Last Saturday, we had an Earth-wide severe storm event, I would call it, and I was expecting something during this period of time, so I moved myself to the far north and was very surprised, because I was watching the weather systems develop around the Earth. It's very severe weather, but was very surprised to find out that there was a lack of auroral activity during this time of severe electrical storm activity. And of course, what we are dealing with here in the month of August, we are moving through the return current sheet, which is kind of like a big snake whipping around the solar system, this being the cause of the severe weather this past weekend. Once again, I'm out of time. Encourage you to call the 800 number, 800-983-5622, for the Berkey water filter offer or the book offer, or visit my webpage at jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.